stomach. "All right, then," I said, my own voice a little too loud in the office. "Thank God that wasn't too creepy or anything." The antique radio on the shelf beside the coffee machine hissed and squalled to life, and I almost jumped out of my shoes. I whirled to face it in a fury, hands clenched.
"Harry!" said a voice on the radio. "Hey, Harry, is this thing working?"
I tried to calm my pounding heart and focused enough will on the radio to let my voice carry through.
"Yeah, Bob, it's me."
"Thank the stars," Bob said.
"You said you wanted to know if I found out anything else ghostly going on."
Yeah, go ahead." The radio hissed and crackled with static, spiritual interference, not physical. The radio wasn't set up to receive AM/FM anymore. Bob's voice was garbled, but I could understand it.
"My contact came through. Cook County Hospital, tonight. Someone stirred up Agatha Hagglethorne. This is a bad one, Harry. She is one mean old biddy."
Bob gave me the rundown on Agatha Hagglethorne's grisly and tragic death and her most likely target at the hospital. I glanced down at my bare left wrist and abruptly felt naked.
"All right," I said. "I'm on it. Thanks, Bob."
The radio squalled and went silent, and I dashed out the door. Sundown would come in less than 20 minutes. Rush hour had been going on for a while, and if I wasn't at Cook County by the time it got dark, all kinds of bad things would happen. I flew out the front door, the sack of ghost dust heavy in my pocket, and all but slammed into Michael, tall and broad, toting a huge athletic bag over his shoulder, which I knew would contain nothing but Amaracus and his white cloak.
"Michael," I burst out, "how did you get here?"
His honest face split into a wide smile.
"When there's a need, he sees to it that I'm there."
"Wow," I said, "you're kidding."
"No," he said, his voice earnest.
Then he paused.
"Of course you've gotten in touch with me every night for the past 2 weeks. Tonight I just thought I'd save him the trouble of arranging coincidence, so I came on over as soon as I got off work."
He fell into step beside me, and we both got into the Blue Beetle. He got into the red door, I got into the white one. And we peered out over the gray hood, and as I pulled the VW into traffic. And that was how we ended up doing battle in the nursery at Cook County.
Anyway, you see what I mean about a day being fairly normal before it falls all to pieces. Or, well, maybe it hadn't been all that normal.
As we took off into traffic, I gave the Beetle all the gas it could take. I got that sinking feeling that my life was about to get hectic again. Chapter 5. Michael and I plunged through the hole I'd torn in reality and into the Never Never. It felt like moving from a sauna into an air-conditioned office, except that I didn't feel the change on my skin. I felt it in my thoughts and my feelings, and in the primitive skin-crawling part of me at the base of my brain. I stood in a different world than our own. The little leather sack of ghost dust in my duster pocket abruptly increased its weight, dragging me off balance and to the ground. I let out a curse. The whole point of ghost dust was that it was something extra real, that it was heavy and inert and locked spiritual matter into place when it touched it. Even inside its bag, it had become a sudden stress on the Never Never. If I opened the bag here, in the spirit world, it might tear a hole in the floor.
I'd have to be careful. I grunted with effort and pulled the little pouch out of my pocket. It felt like it weighed 30 or 40 pounds.
Michael frowned down at my hands.
"You know, I never really thought to ask before, but what is that dust made of?"
"Depleted uranium," I told him. "At least that's the base ingredient. I had to add in a lot of other things. Cold iron, basil, dung from..."
"Never mind," he said. "I don't want to know."
He turned away from me, his arms steadily holding the massive sword before him. I recovered staff and rod and stood beside him, studying the lay of the, as it were, land. This part of Never Never looked like Chicago. At the end of the 19th century... No, strike that. This was the ghost's demesne. It looked like a mishmash of Agatha Hagglethorne's memories of Chicago at the end of her life. Edison's bulbs were mounted at some of the streetlights, while others burned with flickering gas flames. All of them cast hazy spheres of light, doing little to actually illuminate their surroundings. The buildings stood at slightly odd angles to one another, with parts of them seamlessly missing. Everything, streets, sidewalks, buildings, was made of wood. Hell's bells, I muttered. No wonder the real Chicago kept burning down. This place is a tinderbox. Rats moved in the shadows, but the street was otherwise empty and still. The rift that led back to our world wavered and shifted, fluorescent light and sterile hospital air pouring into the old Chicago streets. Around us pulsed maybe a dozen shimmering disturbances in the air, the rich life forces of the infants back in the infirmary, showing through to the never-never. "Where is she?" Michael asked, his voice quiet. "Where's the ghost?" I turned in a slow circle, peering at the shadows, and shook my head. "I don't know, but we'd better find her fast, and we need to get a look at this one if we can." "Try to find out what's gotten it stirred up," Michael said. "Exactly. I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little tired of chasing all over town every night." "Didn't you already get a look at her?" "Not the right kind of look," I said with a grimace. "There could be spells laid on her, some kind of magic around her to clue me in on what's going on. I need to not be in mortal peril for a couple of minutes to examine her."
"Provided she doesn't kill us first, all right," Michael assented. "But time is short, and I don't see her anywhere. What should we do?"
"I hate to say it," I said, "but I think we should..." I was going to say split up, but I didn't get the chance. The heavy wooden timbers of the roadway beneath us exploded up and out in a deadly cloud of splinters. I threw one leather-clad arm across my eyes and went tumbling one way. Michael went the other.
"My little angels! Mine! Mine! Mine!" screamed a voice that roared against my face and chest and made my duster flap around as though made of gauze. I looked up to see the ghost, quite real and solid now, clawing its one-armed way up from the sub-street. Agatha's face was lean and bony, twisted in rage, and her hair hung about her in a shaggy mane, sharply at odds with her crisp white shirt. Her arm was missing from its shoulder, and the dark fluid stained the cloth beneath it. Michael rose to his feet with a shout, one of his cheeks cut and bleeding, and went after her with Amaracus. The spirit backhanded him away with her remaining arm as though he weighed no more than a doll. Michael grunted and went flying, rolling across the wooden street. And then, snarling and drooling, her eyes wide with frenzied madness, the ghost turned toward me. I scrambled to my feet and held out my staff across my body, a slender barrier between me and the ghost on its home turf.
"I guess it's too late to have a reasonable discussion, Agatha."
"My babies!" she screamed. "Mine! Mine! Mine!"
"Yeah, that's what I thought," I breathed. I gathered my forces and started channeling them through my staff. The pale wood began glowing with a gold and orange light spreading out before me in a quarter-dome shape. The ghost screamed again and hurtled towards me. I stood fast and shouted, "Reflectum!" at the top of my lungs. The spirit impacted against my shield with all the momentum of a bull rhinoceros on steroids. I stopped bullets and worse with that shield before, but that was on my home turf in the real world. Here, in the never-never, Agatha's ghosts overloaded my shield, which detonated with a thunderous roar and sent me sprawling to the ground. Again, I jammed my scorched staff into the ground and groaned to my feet. Blood stained my tingling fingers, the skin swelling with dark bruises and burst blood vessels. Agatha stood several paces away, shaking with rage, or if I was lucky, with confusion. Bits of my shield fire played over her shape and slowly winked out. I fumbled for my blasting rod, but my fingers had gone numb, and I dropped it. I went over to pick it up, swayed, and stood up again, red mist and sparkling dots swimming through my vision. Michael circled the stunned spirit and arrived at my side. His expression was concerned rather than frightened. "Easy, Harry, easy. Good Lord, man, are you all right?"
"I'll make it," I croaked. "There's good news and bad news."
The knight brought his sword to guard again.
"I've always been partial to the good news."
"I don't think she's interested in those babies anymore."
Michael flashed me a swift smile. "That is good news." I wiped the sweat from my eyes. My hand came away scarlet. I must have gotten a cut somewhere along the way.
"The bad news is that she's going to come over here and tear us apart in a couple more seconds.
not to be negative, but I'm afraid the news gets worse, Michael said. Listen. I glanced at him and cocked my head to one side. Distantly, but quickly growing nearer, I could hear haunting, musical baying, ghostly in the midnight air. Holy shit, I breathed. Hellhounds. Harry, Michael said sternly, you know I hate it when you swear. You're right. Sorry. Holy shit, I breathed. Heckhounds. Godmother's out hunting. How the hell did she find us so damn fast? Michael grimaced at me. She must have been close already. How long before she gets here? Not long. My shield made a lot of noise when it buckled. She'll home in on it. If you want to go, Harry, Michael said, go on and leave. I'll hold the ghost until you get back through the rift. I was tempted. There aren't a lot of things that scare me more than the Never Never and my godmother in tandem. But I was also angry. I hate it when I get shown up. Besides, Michael was a friend, and I'm not in the habit of leaving friends to clean up my messes for me. No, I said. Let's just hurry. Michael grinned at me and started forward, just as Agatha's ghost extinguished the last residual bits of my magic that had been plaguing it. Michael sent Amaracus whistling at the ghost, but she was unthinkably fast, and dodged each blow with a circling, swooping sort of grace. I lifted my blasting rod and narrowed my focus. I tuned out the baying of the hellhounds, now a lot nearer, and the sound of galloping hoofbeats that set my pulse racing. I methodically blanked out everything but the ghost, Michael, and the power funneling into the blasting rod. The ghost must have sensed the strike gathering, because she turned and flew at me like a bullet. Her mouth opened in a scream, and I could see jagged, pointed teeth lining her jaws, the empty white fire of her eyes. Fuego! I shouted, and then the spirit hit me, full force. A beam of white fire spewed out from my blasting rod and across the wooden storefronts. They burst into flame as though soaked in gasoline. I went down, rolling, the spirit going after my throat with her teeth. I jammed the end of the blasting rod into her mouth and prepared to fire again. But she tore it from my hands with a ferocious dog-like worrying motion, and it tumbled away. I swiped the staff at her awkwardly, to no avail. She went for my throat again. I shoved the leather-clad forearm into her mouth and shouted, Michael! The ghost ripped at me with her nails and clamped down on my forearm. I dropped the ghost dust and scrabbled furiously at her with my free hand, trying to lever her off of me, but it didn't do much more than muss up her clothing. She got her hand on my throat, and I could feel my breath cut off. I wreathed and struggled to escape, but the snarling ghost was a lot stronger and faster than me. Stars swam in front of my eyes. Michael shouted and swept Amaracus at the spirit. The great blade bit into her back with a wooden-sounding thunk that made her arch up, screaming in pain. It was a death blow. The white light of the blade touched her spirit flesh and set it alight, sizzling away from the edges of the wound. She twisted, screaming in fury, and the motion jerked the blade from Michael's hands. Agatha Hagglethorne's blazing ghost prepared to fly at his throat. I sat up, seized the sack of ghost dust, and with a grunt of effort, swept it at the back of her head. There was a sharp sound when the improvised kosh struck her, the super-heavy matter I'd enchanted hitting like a sledgehammer on china. The ghost froze in place for a moment, her feral mouth wide, and then toppled slowly to one side. I looked up at Michael, who stood gasping for breath, staring at me. Harry, he said, do you see? I lifted a hand to my aching throat and looked around me. The sounds of baying hounds and thundering hooves had gone. See what? I asked. Look, he pointed at the smoldering ghost corpse. I looked. In my struggles with Agatha's ghost, I had torn aside the prim white shirt, and she must have ripped up the dress when she'd been crashing through the sidewalls and strangling wizards and so on. I crawled a bit closer to the corpse. It was burning, not blazing, but steadily being eaten away by Amaracus's white fire, like newsprint slowly curling into flame. The fire didn't hide what Michael was talking about, though. Wire? Strands of barbed wire ran about the ghost's flesh, beneath her torn clothing. The barbs had cut cruelly into her flesh every 2 inches or so, and her body was covered with small, agonizing wounds. I grimaced, picking away at the burning cloth in tentative jerks. The wire was a single strand that began at her throat and wrapped about her torso, beneath her arms, winding all the way down one leg to her ankle. At either end, the wire simply vanished into her flesh.
Sun and stars, I breathed. No wonder she went mad.
The wire? Michael asked, crouching down next to me. It was hurting the ghost? I nodded.
Looks like. Torturing it.
Why didn't we see this in the hospital? I shook my head.
Whatever this is, I'm not sure it would be visible in the real world. I don't think we would have seen it if we hadn't come here.
God smiled on us, Michael said. I eyed my own injuries, then glowered at the bruises already spreading over Michael's arm and throat.
Yeah, whatever.
Look, Michael, this kind of thing doesn't just happen. Someone had to do it to this ghost.
Which implies, Michael said, that they had a reason to want this ghost to hurt those children.
His face darkened into a scowl.
Whether or not that was their goal, what it implies is that someone is behind all the recent activity, not some thing or condition. Someone is purposely doing this to the ghosts in the area.
I stood up and brushed myself off as the corpse continued to burn, like the buildings around us. Fire raged up the sides of anything vertical and began to chew its way across the streets and sidewalks as well. A haze of smoke filled the air as the spirit's demison in the Never Never crumbled along with its remains.
Ow, I complained. I keep my complaints succinct.
Michael took the handle of his sword and drew it out of the flames, shaking his head.
The city is burning.
Thank you, Sir Obvious.
He smiled. Can the flames hurt us?
Yes, I said emphatic. Time to go.
Together we headed back to the rift at a quick trot. At one point Michael shouldered me out of the way of a tumbling chimney, and we had to skirt around a pile of shattered bricks and blazing timbers.
Wait, I said suddenly. Wait. Do you hear that?
Michael kept hustling over the ground toward the rift.
Hear what? I don't hear anything.
Yeah, I coughed. No more hounds howling. A very tall, slender, inhumanly beautiful woman stepped out of the smoke. Reddish hair curled down past her hips in a riotous cascade, complementing her flawless skin, high cheekbones, and lush, full blood-red lips. Her face was ageless, and her golden eyes had vertical slits instead of pupils like a cat. Her gown was a flowing affair of deep green.
"Hello, my son," Leah purred, evidently unaffected by the smoke and unconcerned about the fire.
Three great shapes, like mastiffs built from shadows and soot, crouched about her feet, watching us with flat black eyes. They stood between us and the rift that led back home. I swallowed and forced down a sudden feeling of childlike panic that started gibbering down in my belly and threatened to come dancing up out of my throat. I stepped forward between the fairy and Michael and said in a rough voice,
"Hello, Godmother."
Chapter 6. My godmother looked around at the inferno and smiled.
"It reminds me of times gone by. Doesn't it remind you, my sweet?"
She idly reached down and stroked the head of one of the hounds at her side.
"However did you find me so quickly, Godmother?" I asked. She gave the hellhound a benign smile.
"I have my little secrets, sweet. I only wanted to greet my long-estranged godson."
"All right, hi. Good to see you. Have to do it again sometime," I said.
Smoke curled up into my mouth and I started coughing.
"We're kind of in a hurry here, so..."
Leah laughed, a sound like bells, just a shade out of tune.
"Always in a rush. You mortals. But we haven't seen each other in ages, Harry."
She walked closer, her body moving with a lithe, sensual grace that might have been mesmerizing in other circumstances. The hounds spread out silently behind her.
"We should spend some time together."
Michael lifted his sword again and then said calmly, "Madam, step from our path, if you please."
"It does not please me," she spat, sudden and vicious.
Those rich lips peeled back from dainty, sharp canines. And at the same time, the three shadowy hounds let out bubbling growls. Her golden eyes swept past Michael and back to me.
"He is mine, Sir Knight, by blood right, by law, and by his own broken word. He has made a compact with me. You have no power over that."
"Harry," Michael shot me a quick look, "is what she says true?" I licked my lips and gripped my staff.
"I was a lot younger then, and a lot more stupid. Harry, if you've made a covenant with her of your own free will, then she is right. There is little I can do to stop her."
Another building fell with a roar. The fires gathered around us, and it got hot. Really, really hot. The rift wavered, growing smaller. We didn't have much time left.
"Come on, Harry," Leah purred, her voice gone, pardon the pun, smoky again. "Let the good knight of the white god pass on his way, and let me take you to waters that will soothe your hurts and balm your ills."
Sounded like a good idea. Sounded really good. Her own magic saw to that. I felt my feet moving toward her in a slow, leaden shuffling.
"Dresden," Michael said sharply. "Good Lord, man, what are you doing?"
"Go home, Michael," I said. My voice came out thick, dull, as though I'd been drinking. I saw Leah's mouth, her soft, lovely mouth, curl upward in a triumphant smirk. I didn't try to fight the pull of the magic. I wouldn't have been able to stop my legs in any case. Leah had had my number for years. As far as I could tell, she always would. I hadn't a prayer of taking control back for more than a few seconds. The air grew cooler as I got closer to her, and I could smell her body, her hair, like wildflowers and musky earth, intoxicating.
"There isn't much time before the rift closes. Go home."
"Harry!" Michael shouted. Leah placed one long-fingered, slender hand upon my cheek. A wash of tingling pleasure went through me. My body reacted to her, helpless and demanding at the same time. I had to fight to keep thoughts of her beauty from preoccupying me altogether.
"Yes, my sweet man," Leah whispered, golden eyes bright with glee. "Sweet, sweet, sweet. Now lay aside your rod and staff."
I watched dully as my fingers released both. They clattered to the ground. The flames grew closer, but I didn't feel them. The rift glowed and shrank, almost closed. I narrowed my eyes, gathered my will.
"Will you complete your bargain now, sweet mortal child?" Leah murmured, sliding her hands over my chest and then over my shoulders.
"I will go with you," I answered, letting my voice come out thick, slow. Her eyes lit with malicious glee. She threw her head back and laughed, revealing creamy, delicious expanses of throat and bosom.
"When hell freezes over," I added, and drew out the little sack of ghost dust for the last time.
I dumped it all over and down the previously mentioned bosom.
"There isn't much lore about fairies and depleted uranium yet, but there's a ton about fairies and coal iron. They don't like it, and the iron content of the dust's formula was pretty high."
Leah's flawless complexion immediately split into fiery scarlet welts, the skin drying and cracking before my eyes. Leah's triumphant laugh turned into an agonized scream, and she released me, tearing her silken gown away from her chest in a panic, revealing more gorgeous flesh being riven by the cold iron.
"Michael!" I shouted. "Now!"
I gave my godmother a stiff shove, scooped up my staff and rod, and dove for the rift. I heard a snarl, something fastened about one of my boots, dragging me to the ground. I thrust my staff down at one of the hellhounds, and the wood struck it in one of its eyes. It roared in rage, and its two packmates came rushing towards me. Michael stepped in the way and swept his sword at one of them. The true iron struck the fairy beast, and blood and white fire erupted from the wound.
The second one leapt upon Michael and fastened its fangs onto his thigh, ripping and jerking. I brought my staff down hard on the beast's skull, driving it off Michael's leg, and started dragging my friend back toward the swiftly vanishing line of the rift. More hellhounds appeared, rushing from the burning ruins around us. "Come on," I shouted. "There's no time."
"Treacher!"
spat my godmother. She rose up from the ground, blackened and burned, her fine dress in tatters about her waist, her body and limbs stretched, knobby and inhuman. She clenched her hands into fists at her sides, and the fire from the building around us seemed to rush down, gathering in her grasp in a pair of blazing points of violet and emerald light.
"Treasonous, poisonous child! You are mine as your mother swore unto me, as you swore!"
"You shouldn't make contracts with a minor," I shouted back, and shoved Michael forward into the rift. He wavered for a moment on the narrow opening, and then fell through and vanished back into the real world.
"If you will not give me your life, serpent child, then I will have your blood."
Leah took two huge strides toward me and hurled both hands forward. A thunderbolt of braided emerald and violet power rushed at my face. I hurled myself backwards at the rift and prayed that it was still open enough to let me fall through. I extended my staff toward my godmother and threw up whatever weak shield I could. The fairy fire hammered into my shield, hurling me back into the rift like a straw before a tornado. I felt my staff smolder and burst into flames in my hand as I went sailing through. I landed on the floor of the nursery back in the Cook County Hospital, my leather duster trailing off in a shroud of smoke that swiftly converted itself into a thin, disgusting coating of residual ectoplasm, while my staff burned with weird green and purple fire. Babies in their little glass cribs screamed lustily all around me, confused voices babbling from the next room. Then the rift closed, and we were back in the real world, surrounded by crying babies. The fluorescent lights all came back up, and we could hear more worried words from the nurses back at the duty station. I beat out the fires on my staff, and then sat there, panting and hurting. None of the matter of the Never Never may have come back to the real world, but the injuries gained there were very real. Michael got up and looked around at the babies, making sure they were all in satisfactory condition. Then he sat down next to me, wiped the patina of ectoplasm from his brow, and started pressing the material of his cloak against the oozing gashes from his leg, where the hellhound's fangs had sunk in through his jeans. He gave me a pensive, frowning stare.
"What?" I asked him.
"Your godmother. You got away from her," he said. I laughed weakly.
"This time, yeah. So what's bothering you?"
"You lied to her to do it."
"I tricked her," I countered. "Classic tactics with fairies."
He blinked, and then used another section of his cloak to clean the ecto-gook off of Amaracus.
"I just thought you were an honest man, Harry," he said, his expression injured.
"Can't believe you lied to her."
I started to laugh weakly, too exhausted to move.
"You can't believe I lied to her?"
"Well, no," he said, his voice defensive. "That's not the way we're supposed to win. We're the good guys, Harry."
I laughed some more and wiped a trickle of blood off my face.
"Well, we are."
Some kind of alarm started going off. One of the nurses stepped into the observation room, took one look at the pair of us, and ran out screaming.
"You know what bothers me?" I asked.
"What's that?" I set my scorched staff and rod aside. "I'm wondering how in the world my godmother happened to be right at hand when I stepped through into Never Never. It isn't like the place is a small neighborhood. I wasn't there 5 minutes before she showed up." Michael sheathed his sword and set it carefully aside, out of easy arm's reach, then unfastened his cloak, wincing.
"Yeah, it seems like an unlikely coincidence."
We both put our hands on top of our heads as a Chicago PD patrolman, his jacket and pants stained with spilled coffee, burst into the nursery, gun drawn. We both sat there with our hands on our heads and did our best to look friendly and non-threatening.
"Don't worry," Michael said quietly. "Just let me do the talking."
Chapter 7.
Michael rested his chin in his hands and sighed. I can't believe we're in jail. Disturbing the peace, I snorted, pacing the confines of the holding cell. Trespass. Ha! They'd have seen disturbed peace if we hadn't showed up. I jerked a fistful of citations out of my pants pocket. Look at this. Speeding, failure to obey traffic signs, dangerous and reckless operation of a motor vehicle. Oh, yeah, here's the best one. Illegal parking. I'm going to lose my license. You can't blame them, Harry. It isn't as though we could explain what happened in terms that they would understand. I kicked the bars in frustration. Pain lanced up my leg and I immediately regretted it. They'd taken away my boots when I'd been through processing. Adding to my aching ribs, the wounds on my head, and my stiffening fingers, it was too much. I sat down on the bench next to Michael, and with a woof of expelled breath, I get so sick of that, I said. People like you and me stand up to things that these jokers, I made an all-encompassing gesture, would never even dream existed. We don't get paid for it. We hardly even get thanked for it. Michael's tone was unruffled, philosophical. It's the nature of the beast, Harry. I don't mind it so much. I just hate it when something like this happens. I stood up, frustrated again, and started pacing the interior of the cell. What really galls me is that we still don't know why the spirit world's so jumpy. This is big, Michael. If we don't pin down what's causing it, who's causing it? Right. Who's causing it? Who knows what could happen? Michael half-smiled. The Lord will never give you a burden bigger than your shoulders can bear, Harry. All we can do is face what comes and have faith. I gave him a sour glance. I need to get myself some bigger shoulders, then. Someone in accounting must have made a mistake. Michael let out a rough, warm laugh and shook his head, then lay back on the bench, crossing his arms beneath his head. What we did was right. Isn't that enough? I thought of all those babies, snuffling and making cute, piteous little sounds as the nurses had rushed about, gathering them up and making sure they were all right, carrying them off to their mommies. One fat little Gerber candidate had simply let out an enormous burp and promptly fallen asleep on the nurse's shoulder. About a dozen little lives, all told, with an open future laid out before them, a future that would have abruptly ended if I hadn't acted. I felt a stupid little smile playing at the corners of my mouth, and a very small, very concrete sense of satisfaction that my indignation hadn't managed to erase. I turned away from Michael so he wouldn't see the smile, and forced myself to sound resigned. Is it enough? I guess it's gonna have to be. Michael laughed again. I flashed him a scowl, and it only drew more merry laughter, so I gave up trying and just leaned against the bars. How long before we get out of here, do you think? I've never been bailed out of jail before, Michael said. You'd be a better judge. Hey, I protested. What's that supposed to mean? Michael's smile faded. Charity, he predicted, is not going to be very happy. I winced. Michael's wife. Yeah, well, all we can do is face what comes and have faith, right? Michael grunted, somehow making it wry. I'll say a prayer to St. Jude. I leaned my head against the bars and closed my eyes. I ached in places I didn't know could ache. I could have dozed off right there. All I want, I said, is to get home, get clean, and go to sleep. An hour or so later, a uniformed officer appeared and opened the door, informing us that we'd made bail. I got a sickly little feeling in my stomach. Michael and I shuffled out of the holding area into the adjacent waiting room. A woman in a roomy dress and a heavy cardigan stood waiting for us, her arms folded over her seventh or eighth month of pregnancy. She was tall, with gorgeous silken blonde hair that fell to her waist in a shining curtain, timelessly lovely features, and dark eyes smoldering with contained anger. Michael Joseph Patrick Carpenter, she snapped, and stalked toward us. Well, actually, she waddled, but the set of her shoulders and her determined expression made it look like a stalk. You're a mess. This is what comes of taking up with bad company. Hello, angel, Michael rumbled, and leaned over to give the woman a kiss on the cheek. She accepted it with all the loving tolerance of a Komodo dragon.
Don't you hello angel me. Do you know what I had to go through to find a babysitter, get all the way out here, get money together, and then get the sword back for you?
Hi, Charity, I said brightly. Gee, it's good to see you. It's been, what, 3 or 4 years since we've talked?
5 years, Mr. Dresden, the woman said, shooting me a glare. And the good Lord willing, it will be 5 more before I have to put up with your idiocy again.
But I... She thrust her swollen stomach at me like the ram of a Greek warship.
Every time you come nosing around, you get Michael into some sort of trouble, and now jail. What will the children think?
Look, Charity, it was really important...
Mrs. Carpenter, she snarled. It's always really important, Mr. Dresden. Well, my husband has engaged in many important activities without what I dubiously term your help. But it's only when you're around that he seems to come back to me covered in blood.
Hey, I protested. I got hurt, too.
Good, she said. Maybe it will make you more cautious in the future.
I scowled down at the woman.
I'll have you know.
She grabbed the front of my shirt and dragged my face down to hers. She was surprisingly strong, and she could glare right at me without looking me square in the eyes.
I'll have you know, she said, her voice steely, that if you ever get my Michael into trouble so deep that he can't come home to his family, I will make you sorry for it.
Tears that had nothing to do with weakness made her eyes bright for a moment, and she shook with emotion. I have to admit, at that particular point, her threat scared me, waddling pregnancy and all. She finally released me and turned back to her husband, gently touching the dark scab on his face. Michael put his arms around her, and with a little cry, she hugged him back, burying her face against his chest and weeping without making any sound. Michael held her very carefully, as if he were afraid of breaking her, and stroked her head. I stood there for a second like a floundering goob. Michael looked up at me and met my gaze for a moment. He then turned, keeping his wife under one arm, and started walking away. I watched the two of them for a moment, walking in step beside one another, while I stood there alone. Then I stuck my hands into my pockets and turned away. I had never noticed before how well the two of them matched one another. Michael, with his quiet strength and unfailing reliability, and Charity, with her blazing passion and unshakable loyalty to her husband. The married thing. Sometimes I look at it and feel like someone from a Dickens novel, standing outside in the cold and staring in at Christmas dinner. Relationships had never really worked for me. I think it's had something to do with all the demons, ghosts, and human sacrifice. As I stood there, brooding, I sensed her presence before I smelled her perfume, a warmth and energy about her that I'd grown to know over the time we'd spent together. Susan paused at the door of the waiting room, looking back over her shoulder. I studied her. I never got tired of that. Susan had dark skin, tanned even darker from our previous weekend at the beach, and raven black hair cut off neatly at her shoulders. She was slender, but curved enough to draw an admiring look from the officer behind the counter as she stood there, in a flirty little skirt and half-top which left her midriff bare. My phone call caught her just as she was leaving for our rendezvous. She turned to me and smiled, her chocolate-colored eyes worried but warm. She tilted her head back behind her where Michael and Charity had gone. They're a beautiful couple, aren't they? I tried to smile back, but didn't do so well. They got off to a good start. Susan's eyes studied my face, the cuts there, and the worry in her eyes deepened. Oh? How's that? He rescued her from a fire-breathing dragon. I walked toward her. Sounds nice, she said, and met me halfway, giving me a long and gentle hug that made my bruised ribs ache. You okay?
I'll be okay.
More ghost-busting with Michael. What's his story?
Off the record? Publicity could hurt him. He's got kids.
Susan frowned but nodded. All right, she said, and added a flare of melodrama to her words.
So, what is he?
Some kind of eternal soldier? Maybe a sleeping Arthurian knight woken up in this desperate age to battle the forces of evil? As far as I know, he's a carpenter. Susan arched a brow at me. Who fights ghosts? What, has he got a magic nail gun or something? I tried not to smile. The muscles of the corner of my mouth ached. Not quite. He's a righteous man. He seemed nice enough to me. No, not self-righteous. Righteous. The real deal. He's honest, loyal, faithful. He lives his ideals. It gives him power. Susan frowned. He looks average enough. I'd have expected, I'm not sure, something. A different attitude. That's because he's humble, too, I said. If it asked him if he was righteous, he'd laugh at the idea. I guess that's part of it. I never met anyone like him. He's a good man. She pursed her lips. And the sword? Amaracus, I supplied. He named his sword. How very Freudian of him. But his wife just about reached down that clerk's throat to get it back. It's important to him, I said. He believes that it's one of the three weapons given by God to mankind. Three swords. Each of them has a nail that is supposed to be from the cross worked into its design. Only one of the righteous can wield them. The ones who do call themselves the Knights of the Cross. Others call them the Knights of the Sword. Susan frowned. The cross? She said. As in the crucifixion? Capital C? I shrugged uncomfortably. How should I know? Michael believes it. That kind of belief is a power of its own. Maybe that's enough. I took a breath and changed the subject. Anyway, my car got impounded. I had to drive fast, and the CPD didn't like it. Her dark eyes sparkled. Anything worth a story? I laughed tiredly. Don't you ever give up. A girl's got to earn a living, she said, and fell into step beside me on the way out, slipping her arm through mine. Maybe tomorrow. I just want to get back home and get some sleep. No date, I guess, she smiled up at me, but I could see the expression was strained around the edges. I know, she sighed. I shortened my steps a little, and she lengthened hers, though neither of us moved quickly. I know what you're doing is important, Harry. I just wish sometimes that... She broke off, frowning. That what? Nothing, really. It's selfish. That what? I repeated. I found her hand with my bruised fingers and squeezed it gently. She sighed and stopped in the hall, turning to face me. She took both of my hands and didn't look up when she said, I just wish that I could be that important to you, too. An uncomfortable pang hit me in the middle of my sternum. Ow. It hurt to hear that, literally. Susan, I stammered, hey, don't ever think that you're not important to me. Oh, she said, still not looking up, it's not that. Like I said, just selfish. I'll get over it. I just don't want you to feel like... I frowned and took a breath. I don't want you to think that I don't... What I mean to say is that I... love you. That should have been simple enough to say, but the words stuck hard in my throat. I'd never said them to anyone I didn't lose, and every time I told my mouth to make the sounds, something shut down somewhere along the way. Susan looked up at me, her eyes flickering over my face. She reached up a hand and touched the bandage on my forehead, her fingers light, gentle, warm. Silence fell heavy on the hallway, and I stood there, staring stupidly at her. Finally, I leaned down and I kissed her. Hard. Like I was trying to push the words out of my useless mouth and into her. I didn't know if she would understand, but she melted into me. All warm, soft tension. Smelling of cinnamon. The sweetness of her lips soft and pliant beneath mine. One of my hands drifted to the small of her back, to the smooth, rounded ridges of muscle on either side of her spine, and drew her against me a little harder. Footsteps coming from the other direction made us both smile and break away from the kiss. A female officer walked by. Her lips twisted into a knowing little smirk, and I felt my cheeks flush. Susan took my hand from her back, bending her mouth to put a gentle kiss on my bruised fingers. Don't think you're getting off that easy, Harry Dresden, she said. I'm going to get you to start talking if it kills you. but she didn't press the issue, and together we reclaimed my stuff and left. I fell asleep on the drive back to my apartment, but I woke up when the car crunched into the gravel parking lot beside the stone stairs leading down to my lair in the basement of an old boarding house. We got out of the car, and I stretched, looking around the summer night with a scowl. "What's wrong?" Susan asked.
"Mister," I said. "He's usually running right up to me when I come home. I let him out early this morning."
"He's a cat, Harry," Susan said, flashing me with a smile. "Maybe he's got a date."
"What if he got hit by a car? What if a dog got him?"
Susan let out a laugh and walked over to me. My libido noted the sway of her hips in the little skirt with an interest that made my aching muscles cringe.
"He's as big as a horse, Harry. I pity the dog that tries something."
I reached back into the car for my staff and rod, and then slipped an arm around her. Susan's warmth beside me, the scent of cinnamon drifting up to me from her hair, felt incredibly nice at the end of a long day. But it just didn't feel right to not have Mister run up to me and bowl into my shins in greeting. That should have been enough to tip me off. I'll plead weariness, achiness, and sexual distraction. It came as a total shock to me to feel a wave of cold energy wreathe into my face in tandem with a shadowy form rising up from the steps leading down to my apartment. I froze and took a step back, only to see another silent shape step around the edge of the boarding house and start walking toward us. Goose flesh erupted up and down my arms. Susan caught on a second or two after my wizard senses had given me warning. "Harry," she breathed, "what is it? Who are they?" "Take it easy and get out your car keys," I said, as the two shapes approached us, the waves of cool energy increasing as they did. Light from the distant street lamps reflected in the nearest figure's eyes, gleaming huge and black. "We're getting out of here. They're vampires." Chapter 8. One of the vampires let out a velvety laugh and stepped out into the dim light. He wasn't particularly tall, and he moved with a casual and dangerous grace that belied his crystal blue eyes, styled blonde hair, and the tennis whites he wore.
"Bianca told us you'd be nervous," he purred.
The second of the pair kept coming toward us from the corner of the boarding house. She, too, was of innocuous height and build, and possessed the same blue eyes and flawless golden hair as the man. She, too, was dressed in tennis whites.
"But," she breathed and licked her lips with a cat-like tongue, "she didn't tell us that you would smell so delicious."
Susan fumbled with her keys and pressed up against me, tight with tension and fear.
"Harry!"
"Don't look them in the eyes," I said, "and don't let them lick you." Susan shot me a sharp look from beneath raven brows.
"Lick?"
"Yeah. That saliva's like some kind of addictive narcotic." We reached her car. "Get in." The male vampire opened his mouth, showing his fangs, and laughed.
"Peace, wizard. We're not here for your blood."
"Speak for yourself," the girl said. She licked her lips again, and this time I could see the black spots on her long pink tongue.
"Eeg."
The male smiled and put a hand on her shoulder, a gesture that was half affection, half physical restraint.
"My sister hasn't eaten tonight," he explained. "She's on a diet."
"Vampires on a diet?" Susan murmured beneath her breath.
"Yeah,"
I said back, sotto voice.
"Make hers a blood light."
Susan made a choking sound. I eyed the male and raised my voice.
"Who are you, then, and why are you at my house?"
He inclined his head politely.
"My name is Kyle Hamilton. This is my sister, Kelly. We are associates of Madame Bianca's, and we are here to give you a message. An invitation, actually."
"It only takes one of you to deliver a message." Kyle glanced at his sister.
"We were just on the way to our game of doubles."
I snorted.
"Yeah, right," I told him. "Whatever it is you're selling, I don't want any. You can go now."
Kyle frowned.
"I urge you to reconsider, Mr. Dresden. You, of all people, should know Madame Bianca is the most influential vampire in the city of Chicago. Denying her invitation
could have grave consequences. I don't like threats, I shot back. I hefted my blasting rod and leveled it at Kyle's baby blues. Keep it up, and there's going to be a greasy spot right about where you're standing. The pair of them smiled at me, innocent angels with pointed teeth. Please, Mr. Dresden, Kyle said. Understand that I'm only pointing out the potential hazards of a diplomatic incident between the Vampire Court and the White Council. Whoops. That changed things. I hesitated and then lowered the blasting rod. This is court business? Official business? The Vampire Court, Kyle said, a measured cadence to his word, extends a formal invitation to Harry Dresden, wizard, as the local representative of the White Council of Wizards, to attend the reception celebrating the elevation of Bianca St. Clair to the ranks of Margravine of the Vampire Court. 3 nights hence, reception to begin at midnight. Kyle paused to produce an expensive-looking white envelope and to refresh his smile. The safety of all invited guests is assured by word of the assembled court, of course. Harry, Susan breathed, what is going on? I'll tell you in a minute, I said. I stepped away from Susan. You're acting as an ordained herald of the court, then?
I am, Kyle said.
I nodded. Bring me the invitation. The pair of them started toward me. I lifted my blasting rod and muttered a word. Power flooded through the rod, and the far tip began to blow with an incandescent light. Not her, I said, nodding to the herald sister. Just you. Kyle kept his smile, but his eyes had changed from blue to a shade of angry black that was rapidly expanding to cover the whites.
Well, he said, his voice tense, aren't we a little lawyer, Mr. Dresden?
I smiled back at him. Look, Sparky, you're the herald. You should know the accords as well as I do. You've licensed to deliver and receive message and to have safe passage granted to you so long as you don't start any trouble. I waved the tip of the rod toward the girl beside him. She doesn't, and she's not obliged to keep the peace either. Let's just say that I'd rather we all walked away from this. They both made a hissing sound that no human could quite have duplicated. Kyle pushed Kelly roughly back behind him, where she remained, her soft-looking hands pressed to his stomach, her eyes flooded entirely black and empty of humanity. Kyle stalked toward me and thrust the envelope at me. I swallowed my fear, lowered my blasting rod, and took it. Your business here is complete, I told him. Blow.
You'd better be there, Dresden, Kyle snarled, pacing back to his sister's side. My lady will be most upset if you are not.
I told you to blow, Kyle. I lifted my hand, gathered my anger and my fear as handy sources of fuel, and said quietly,
Ventas servitas.
Energy flowed out of me. Wind roared up in response to my command and whipped out toward the pair of vampires, carrying a cloud of dust and dirt and debris with it. They both staggered, lifting a hand to shield their eyes against flying particles. As the wind faded, I sagged, wearied by the effort of moving that much air, and watched the vampires gather their wits and blink their eyes clear. Their perfect tennis whites were stained, their beautiful complexions were must, and best of all, their flawless hair was standing up every which way. They hissed at me and crouched, bodies oddly balanced and held with an inhuman lightness. Then there was a blur of tennis whites, and they were gone. I didn't assume that they had left until I let my senses drift out from me, tasting the air for the cold energy that had surrounded them. It had faded as well. Only then, when I was absolutely sure they were gone, did I relax. Well, it felt like a simple relaxing, but generally, when I relax, I don't stagger and need to plant my staff firmly on the ground to keep from falling over. I stood there like that for a second, my head swimming.
Wow, Susan came toward me, her face concerned. Harry, you sure know how to make friends.
I wobbled a little, hardly able to stand.
I don't need friends like that.
She got close enough for me to lean on and spared my ego by slipping underneath my arm, as though for my protection.
Are you all right?
tired. I've been working too hard tonight. Must have gotten out of shape.
Can you walk?
I gave her a smile that probably looked strained and started walking toward the stairs leading down to my apartment. Mister, my gray cat, came flying over the ground from the darkness somewhere and threw himself fondly against my legs. 30 pounds of cat is a lot of fondness, and I had to have Susan's help to keep him falling over. Eating small children again, mister? My cat meowed, then padded down the stairs and pawed at the door.
So, Susan said, the vampires are throwing a party.
I fished my keys out of my duster pocket. I unlocked the door to the old place, and Mister bolted inside. I shut the door behind us and stared wearily at my living room. The fire had died down to glowing embers, but still shed red golden light over everything. I decorated my apartment in textures, not colors, in any case. I liked the smooth grain of old woods, the heavy tapestries on the bare stone walls. The chairs are all thickly padded and comfortable-looking, and the rugs are strewn over the bare stone floor in a variety of materials, patterns, and weaves from Arabian to Navajo. Susan helped me hobble in until I could collapse on my plushy, cushioned couch. She took my staff and blasting rod from me, wrinkled her nose at the charred smell, and set them in the corner next to my cane sword. Then she came back over to me and knelt down, flashing a lot of bare, pretty leg. She took my boots off, and I groaned as my feet came free.
Thanks, I said.
She plucked the envelope from my hand.
Could you get the candles?
I groaned for an answer, and she sniffed. Big baby, you just want to see me walk around this skirt.
Guilty,
I said. She quirked a smile at me and went to the fireplace. She added a few logs to it from the old tin hod and then stirred the embers with a poker until the licks of flame came up. Gadgets go out so often that there's no point in constantly replacing them. My refrigerator is an old-style icebox, the kind with ice. I shudder to think what I could do to gas lines. So I lived without heat, except for my fireplace, and without hot water, without electricity. The curse of a wizard. It saves on the utility bills, I have to admit, but it can be damned inconvenient. Susan had to bend down far over the fire to thrust the long candlestick's tip down into the small flames. The orange light curved around the lean muscles of her legs in a fashion I found positively fascinating, even as wearied as I was. Susan rose with a lighted candle in her hand and cast a smirk at me.
You're staring, Harry.
Guilty,
I said again. She lit several candles on the mantel from the first, and then opened the white envelope, frowning.
Wow,
she said, and held the invitation inside up to the light. I couldn't make out the words, but they had that white-yellow glint that you only get from true gold.
The bearer, Wizard Harry Dresden, and an escort of his choosing are hereby courteously invited to a reception. I didn't think they used invitations like this anymore.
Vampires. They can be a couple hundred years out of style and not notice.
Harry,
Susan said. She flipped the invitation against the heel of her hand a couple of times.
You know, something occurs to me.
My brain tried to stir from its congealment. Some instinct twitched, warning me that Susan was up to something. I said, blinking my eyes in an effort to clear my thoughts.
I hope you're not thinking what a great opportunity it would be for you to go to the ball.
Her eyes glinted with something very much like lust.
Think of it, Harry. There could be beings there hundreds of years old. I could get enough stories from a half-hour chat to last me.
Hang on, Cinderella, I said. In the first place, I'm not going to the ball. In the second, even if I was, I wouldn't take you with me. Her back straightened and she put one fist on her hip.
And just what is that supposed to mean?
I winced.
Look, Susan, they're vampires. They eat people. You've got no idea how dangerous it would be for me there, or for you, for that matter.
What about what Kyle said? The guarantee of your safety?
Talk is cheap, I said.
Look, everyone in the old circles is big on the old laws of courtesy and hospitality, but you can only trust them to adhere to the letter of the law. If I happen to get served a bad batch of